Yeah. It's the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. I just want to keep that music going, man. I can't say it's a time when I'm walking in here and I'm psyched, man. I'm just psyched. And I'm going to be psyched for the entire hour, so stay tuned, all right? At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Jamel Dolphin and Luis Bisto. Jamel's a producer and author, and Lou is the producer of a play. It's a great play, folks. I saw it when it first came out. It's been out again for another month. It's called Recorded in Hollywood, and I'm going to be talking to those two cats about that. Before that, we'll be listening to some clips from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. That has everything to do with these elections, what's being churned up around it, and internationalism, which goes right up in the face of everything that they're pushing right now. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, on Thursday, July 28th. Carl and notorious flag burner Joey Johnson and the Revolution Club marched in formation and chanted up to Broad Street and Patterson Avenue in Philadelphia outside the Philadelphia Wells Fargo Convention Center on the final night of the Democratic National Convention. The RevComs had pledged that after burning an American flag at the RNC, the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, they were going to burn one in Philadelphia at the DNC, come rain or shine. And damn if they didn't. Before a crowd of over 100 activists, journalists, and reactionaries and others, they lit it up and they brought a whole lot of knowledge and truth to the situation there. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Yeah, well, let's jump into this, man. I have to say, I'm sitting here, I'm looking at this, and I'm thinking, okay, Carl, what's up? What's up with the burning the flag again? You know, we talked to you last week, and you know, you did this, and it's extremely important. You know, let's revisit this. What's up with burning the flag?
Well, what's up with burning the flag is that's the flag that symbolizes all of the horrors that the American global empire has meant for humanity from the very beginning with a country founded on dragging African people to these shores in slave chains, committing genocide against the native inhabitants, and all the way up to today and the drone missile strikes that destroy whole villages in Yemen, in Pakistan. It's the flag that symbolizes the sweatshops in Bangladesh, where people's sweat and their blood go into being almost slave wage laborers for this global imperialist machine. It symbolizes the destruction of the environment and everything else that this empire, this American empire, does against people around the world. And we had both of these conventions, each of which posited a continuation and an intensification of those horrors. And in the face of that, we felt it was very necessary to say, no, fascist Donald Trump, you're not going to make America great again because America never was great. And no, imperialist war criminal Hillary Clinton, America is not great. It never was great. And we need a world without America and everything it stands for. And the burning of the flag symbolizes that stance, including symbolizing our determination to work to bring that world into being. So that was the point to burning the flag at both of the conventions, because I think I spoke earlier about two different futures being put forward to the world and to this country out of these conventions, but not the difference between the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention and Trump's future and Hillary's future, because both of them wrap themselves in the flag of this empire and in the crimes of this empire. And then they differed over which one was best positioned to lead this empire forward. The different future was the one that the Revolution Club was displaying out on the streets, of fighting for a world without America and everything it stands for, acting on Bob Avakian's statement that American lives are not more important than other people's lives. A future of a world without the exploitation and oppression and all the rest that goes with this imperialist system. And a future that could only be brought into being through revolution. And we were in the streets at both conventions actively and actually organizing for an actual revolution at the soonest possible time to overthrow this system and bring a whole different and far better system and way of life for people into being.
Let me ask you this, Carl, and it's a continuation of this, and I think it's fairly important because, you know, just off of everything that you've been saying, you know, this whole thing about when you watched Clinton and you watched Trump the week before, there was a whole situation that was going on here where they kept talking about, and particularly like with Clinton, this idea, she's talking about how she's going to do this for the people of America. She's going to do this for the people of America. Anybody, it was almost like anybody, you got a beef, I'm going to take care of it for you as long as you're a people of America. And I kept thinking about that in relation to what you guys did, what the Rev Club and you and Joey did in relation to this, because it's really important. And I know there were a lot of expressions of, for instance, I think something that brought joy to a lot of people's hearts was the, you know, the people who were, you know, Palestinian flags were around, and that was an issue at the convention, as I understand, or even and outside. But that in particular, even going beyond that, this whole question of internationalism and why that's so damn important.
The 7 billion people on this planet are having their lives strangled by the imperialist system dominated by the United States, the American global empire. And the very environment of the planet is being ground up. Wars for empire that destabilizing whole regions. You've got millions of people who have been killed in these wars from Iraq to Afghanistan to Yemen, now Syria. And then you have countless millions more who have been driven out of their homelands by these wars, on top of the millions and millions of people who've been driven from their homelands by the economic and other dislocation that imperialism, and especially U.S. imperialism, has wrought on people. You know, you talk about NAFTA and what happened to the jobs of people in America. Well, an even bigger impact of NAFTA is the way it destroyed the agriculture of Mexico and sent millions of people who used to support themselves that way flowing across the border into the U.S. in search of work and survival. So the world is very much knit together by this global imperialist system. And it does come down to that humanity needs revolution. It needs to get rid of this system. And that was a message that we were bringing out there. And it was very much in contrast to both of the conventions, because both of the conventions wrapped themselves in this USA number one outlook and approach. And it was kind of like the other side of all of these politicians throwing in the God bless America or the United States of America. And in addition to the fact that I'm an atheist and know that there ain't no God, what's so damn good about a God who would bless only one country? What's up with that? So what about the rest of humanity? And I don't know if people know this, but if you watch the convention, the Democratic National Convention, you'd hear these chants of USA, USA, USA. The backdrop to that is that the Clinton campaign had put out instructions to its delegates, and if anybody chanted no more wars, the response to that was to be USA, USA, USA. If anybody raised environmental chants or chants about the opposing the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, the response to that was to be chanting Hillary, Hillary, Hillary. So when you hear those chants break out, what it was in opposition to was delegates on the floor posing questions, actually critiquing and going against the direction that was being set from the stage. Because, you know, generals coming out and speaking, that's when the No More Wars chants would come up. The former CIA head Leon Panetta coming out and speaking, No More Wars chants come up, and then they were met with USA, USA, USA. Which to me was reminiscent of the Republican National Convention, because that's exactly what would happen when we were in the streets protesting against police brutality, when we burned the flag. The reactionaries who had been drawn to Cleveland by the Trump convention would try to drown us out with, you know, USA, USA, USA. So both of these conventions are grabbing that flag. And it was very refreshing to see the forces who were carrying the Palestinian flags outside around the convention, and some even tried to take it into the convention. I don't know how successful they were on that. They definitely never made the cameras from what I could tell. But it was very much an America first thing at both conventions, with a difference on what's the best way to keep the empire intact, expand and intensify its grip on the whole world.
It's interesting too, Carl, and I think it's really important what you're saying, because even when I was watching it, you'd see Clinton and you'd see her like, you know, she's getting that sort of like, every now and then she'd get that like warm, fuzzy liberal stuff going on and you know, all these things happening. But then immediately when this question of America's role in the world, when this question of is America going to be strong and is its military going to do what it needs to do around the world, the steely-eyed conviction, it was like very heavy, because she would get up there and it's true. In addition to all the people that you were talking about, she had on the Medal of Honor winners, all these people. And she would take on Trump by saying, he's full of it. We have and we are ready to, and we will again and again, as much as needed, conquer the world. We'll bring everybody in line. They will be under to us. And it sort of was very, very heavy to watch that sort of soft liberal thing and all these people like cheering that. And then she would step back and say, and get that steely eyed and that firm conviction of, yeah, we're not backing down. We run the world.
Mm. Yes, that was very much in evidence, and people actually need to look at the reality, because if you're somebody who hated these wars that have been waged, you got to see that, okay, Bush jumped them off with the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Obama continued those wars and upped the ante, leading a NATO-led invasion in Libya and now spreading the war into Syria. And Clinton promises to continue that. Trump says, I can do it even better than she could. That's what they're putting forward. And there is really nowhere you can go in this election that you could say, well, this is how I'm going to vote to further my anti-war stance. There's nowhere you could go in this election to say, this is how I'm going to vote to protect the environment. Because the environment has continued to be destroyed under the so-called environmental president, Obama. And you could just go across the board, immigration. Where do you go if you're concerned about that? Well, Obama set the record for deportations. Millions of people deported, families torn apart, people disappeared. And I could go on that. So you're really being told, if you oppose this stuff, well, you got to go with Hillary because Trump is really scary. Well, what's really scary is people being demobilized and paralyzed and sucked back into the confines of the way this system tells you you carry out your activity. And what's really important and what needs to be the outcome of this is people not backing down from the things that motivated them to come out and stand against these horrors, and to think they could do that through the electoral arena by getting behind Bernie Sanders, only to, after a lot of struggle and sacrifice, to then have Sanders attempt to do the handoff to Clinton and draw his followers to follow him. And there are a lot of people who don't want to do that, and I really encourage that stand, but I say to them, continue to fight these horrors, but also continue to dig to find out where they come from, and to find out that the electoral arena is not where you can stop these horrors. You actually have to do two things. One is you need massive, determined resistance, and even more fundamentally, you need a revolution. We need to get rid of the system that spawns these horrors, that are the reasons why police brutalize and murder black and brown people wantonly in the streets and are never punished, are the reason why the system that's the reason why women face actual violence and rape in horrific numbers. Well, we can end all of this, but it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to do that. And that's why we spread the proclamation from the Central Committee of the Revolutionary Communist Party all over both the conventions. That's why we burned the flag. That's why we marched and chanted things like 1, 2, 3, 4, slavery, genocide, and war. 5, 6, 7, 8, America was never great, and why, along with doing that, we brought out the leadership of Bob Avakian and the need for people to get into the new synthesis of communism that he's developed as a real way out of these horrors, that people don't need to get demoralized or lower their sights and say, well, let's see if we can ease up some of these problems some. Because once you start to do that, then you get drawn into complicity in the continued perpetration of these horrors.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about the conventions, burning the American flag, Hillary Clinton, and the two futures that are confronting people here and around the world. You know, Carl, I want to move on to another subject for the moment, actually, which is another point.
Okay.
And I think it's related to all this, because there's another point here where, you know, you think about this, and we've been talking about the situation. You know, you and I have been talking about it. We run all kinds of things around in relation to police murder of black and brown people, but in particular, yeah, in relation to black people, you could see it everywhere. The attempt to actually portray Clinton and the Democrats as actually, look, we're down with black people. We stand with them. We understand. And, you know, and we want to stop the stuff that they're suffering under. We also want to change the situation within the police departments. But we really understand, and we're down with black people. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, see, that's a very important point to make, because there was a lot of hypocrisy and deception going on in this convention. And that was one of the fronts on which it was really brought to the fore. Hillary Clinton as concerned about the lives of black people, and especially concerned about what the criminal injustice system in this country has perpetrated on black people. I mean, and let's go to the reality. This is a woman who, in the realm of public opinion, promoted policies and laws that devastated black people in particular, that ripped apart black families. I mean, in terms of campaigning for the crime bills that Bill Clinton signed that led to a doubling of the incarceration in this country, and much of it targeted at black people and Latinos. A woman who said in campaigning for this that these black youth are super predators and we have to bring them to heel. She campaigned for laws and policies that militarize the police, military weapons that we're seeing now in the face of protesters standing up and saying police murders got to stop and Black Lives Matter. They're meeting military hardware that the Clinton administration made a big leap in providing to these police departments. And the Obama administration has continued, along with the Bush administration. So then to try to take that and turn it around and say, I'm concerned about the lives of black people and I'm going to do something about it. Let's just get real. Clinton met with the mothers, black mothers in particular, of 7 or 8 people whose children were killed by police or racist vigilantes. She spent a couple hours with them. She has her staff get back to them, and she takes them out on the campaign trail to tell their stories and urge people to vote for her. Okay, but what did she do to fight for justice for any of these families? Nothing. And we should actually look at the way in which she's wrapping herself in the legacy of Obama, because the Obama administration has prosecuted 0 cops for killing black and brown people or killing anybody. 0. Exactly 0. And don't expect them to up that number in the last couple of months, you know, the last few months that Obama has. It's like literally 0 cops have been prosecuted. You know, there have been commissions. There's been talk about policy changes. We're going to do this, we're going to do that. But when it comes down to it, when cops brutalize and murder, they are continuing to be exonerated on the state and local level, and the federal level has done nothing about it. So this is a sham, and there is both deception and self-deception going on. You know, it's people wanting to find some way that they can get justice that doesn't come down to we're going to have to fight for it, and not wanting to see that there's a system that does this. It isn't like a few bad cops. It isn't like we need better training for cops or anything like that. What we need is to get rid of a system that has this kind of official state violence disproportionately targeted at black and brown people. We got to get rid of that system.
Really important point, because it's actually, and that is, it's, I mean, you look at the display of those mothers on the stage that, you know, when Clinton brought them in, and the sort of the cynicism that was attached with that on the part of the system, and the idea that this could then somehow be sort of pushed over and really to play on these people's just sorrow and broken hearts for something that's only going to lead to the continuation of all this, you know, the continuation of it, where you're going to end the year with over 1,000 again, probably. You know, that's not going to be a surprise to anybody. Over 1,000 people killed by the police, you know, and proportionally much higher rates of black people being killed. When it leads to all that, and you're thinking about, damn, this is some cruel stuff, man, you know?
Yeah, and then you add to that the effort, the successful effort to end welfare as we know it, and what that did to black families especially. And again, Hillary Clinton, who's saying, I'm all about the kids, campaigned for that to happen and put a lot of children in situations where they're parents and especially their mothers were forced to work minimum wage jobs with no child care or support, and what that meant for trying to raise families, what the increase in incarceration meant for children whose fathers and increasingly their mothers were ending up in prison. Don't believe from someone who was intricately and intimately involved in all of that that they care about the children and they care about the lives of black people or they care about black families. The reality is screaming out the exact opposite. And people need to go to that reality and look at it for what it is and not fall for this thing of, in some way, this would be the better approach for black people. Then, you know, you got to see to it that Trump doesn't get there, and that means get behind Hillary and all like that. You got to get into a movement that is out to get rid of this system, one that is fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. And that is what the Revolutionary Communist Party is doing, and that's what the Revolution Club was doing at both of these conventions. And people need to dig into that message from the Central Committee that lays out the problem and how it's this system and the solution being revolution and the leadership we have for that solution in Bob Avakian and the questions that he has addressed and broken through on. People need to do that, and they need to go to the website revcom.us to be up on what the revolution is about, what it's doing, writings of Bob Avakian, because this is really a crucial time. I mean, a lot of people got in motion around these elections, particularly people around Bernie Sanders who thought they could do something about some of these horrors. And then they got slapped down in the final analysis. And a lot of them don't want to accept that, don't want to follow Bernie into the Clinton campaign. But they need to know that there is somewhere they can go. They don't need to end up demoralized and figuring there's no way to go forward on what they wanted to do. They need to actually figure out why they were going at that in the wrong way, that it wasn't who was going to be the commander-in-chief of this empire. But this is an empire that's causing these horrors, and how do we get rid of that empire? And that's the message we were taking to the convention. And we want to connect with people who were part of this effort. We want to bring to them, no, the problems you were trying to deal with stem from the nature of this system, and there is a solution, and that solution is revolution, and you need to get with this revolution and get with the leader of this revolution, Bob Avakian.
All right, Carl Dix, that about wraps it up, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
I want to thank you for having me on again, Michael.
All right, take care, man. And people can go to revcom.us to check this all out and to find out ways to get in touch with the revolution. All right, so Carl, talk to you again soon, I hope.
Yeah, sure, Michael. You know how to reach me.
Okay, man, take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with a comment from Bob Avakian. All right, so stay tuned.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war.
All right, Germany, just before the war from Sunny Meadows. Someday I'm going to play that whole song. It's just a mind blower. I'm really attracted to it. Aside from the oompa music, it's just the point. It's the point of where are things at. Okay, sisters and brothers, that's what we got to be dealing with. All right, now I'm going to play two important and relevant statements from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, the first one is a comment from Avakian speaking on Trump, Clinton, lesser evils, and revolution. And the second one will be taken from his DVD, Revolution Nothing Less. And it's the actual name of it is BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. And this second excerpt is Internationalism, The Whole World Comes First. But let's take a listen to Trump, Clinton, Lesser Evils, and Revolution.
The fact that the mainstream media, such as, you know, the ruling class media, such as CNN, continue to treat this election as just one more bourgeois election, and Trump as just, while perhaps odd in certain ways or outside the normal, in the norms in certain ways, as just one more legitimate bourgeois candidate. The fact that they render him legitimate in that way speaks powerfully to the illegitimacy not only of the election but of the whole system. And this, even while we're working to bring forward more analysis of what is represented by these different social phenomena and the different forces who gravitate toward them spontaneously, we need to keep hammering at this point that the legitimacy of Trump, as presented and brought forward by the ruling class institutions, in particular the media, speaks powerfully to the illegitimacy of the whole system. And this gets to the next thing we need to really emphasize or really need to take up. And that is, we need to compellingly make the case that not Clinton and the Democrats, but building for revolution, actually pushing, carrying forward with Fight the Power and Transform the People for Revolution, that, and not falling into voting for Clinton and supporting the Democrats, is the answer, including to what is represented by Trump. We need to emphasize that continually accepting the framework and choices dictated, yes, dictated by this system and its ruling forces and institution, repeatedly rallying to or acquiescing in the lesser evil, only leads to greater and greater evil. We need to emphasize that the more there is resistance to the crimes of this system, as concentrated in the five stops, instead of complicity with these crimes by voting for one or another representative of this system, and the more this resistance becomes part of building for the actual revolution that is needed, the more that Fight the Power and Transform the People for Revolution is carried forward, the better the situation will be, regardless of who prevails in their election. I mean, look, for example, if you want to talk about evil, although I generally don't like to use that word because of its religious connotations, but since the concept of the lesser evil, once again, is coming to the forefront, if you want to talk about evil, look at Clinton. Here now we have these revolting, disgusting ads about how Hillary Clinton cares so much about children. Well, how about the 1.5 million, the 500,000 children that were needlessly killed, murdered, in fact, by the sanctions imposed during the administration of Bill Clinton? And let's give Hillary Clinton her due. She was not and never has been some sort of decorative first lady. She's always been an active and important member of the inner core of the Clinton administration, and now, of course, is on running on her own to be the chief executive and commander-in-chief of this rapacious and murderous system. Think about, besides the children in Iraq murdered in this way while Hillary Clinton was actively involved in the Clinton administration, but think about also the children in the inner cities, in particular of the United States itself, with the ending of welfare under Bill Clinton, the crime bill. Think of the one strike policy that was part of this, in which women or others could be thrown out of public housing if someone who had been convicted of a crime even came to visit them, or if they had a relative who had been convicted of a crime who was living with them. Think of the effect of that on children. Think of the effect of this mass incarceration that was carried forward and furthered by the Clintons during the 1990s. Think of the effect of that on black and brown children, youth, throughout the country.
Okay, welcome back once again. That was Bob Avakian with Trump, Clinton, Lesser Evils, and Revolution. Now check out this one, sisters and brothers. This is from Avakian's DVD, and it's called B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, and the excerpt is called Internationalism, The Whole World Comes First. And believe me, this is extremely important, especially in the climate we got today. So check this out.
So in opposition to the America First chauvinism that is endlessly promoted in this country under this system, and was again openly promoted by Obama in his recent victory speech, what we have to base ourselves on and proceed from is internationalism. Again, go back to the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, draft proposal, and compare it on the question of the country and the relation to the rest of the world with the U.S. Constitution. We have to proceed on internationalism. The whole world comes first, and the goal is the emancipation of all humanity, not the strengthening of our country to be the most powerful country in the world. The building of a powerful movement for revolution in this country, even before things get to the point of all-out revolution, can and should draw great inspiration and important lessons from people rising up in other parts of the world. At the same time, the more a movement for revolution is built in this country, with communist forces and a communist understanding and outlook increasingly becoming its leading core, this will have a tremendous impact, not only in this country, but throughout the world, on oppressed people, and people yearning for a better world everywhere. It will change the whole equation, challenging and transforming how people throughout the world who learn of this think about and see the possibilities of radical change. We should understand the dialectical relation, the back and forth impact and influence between building for and then when the conditions are ripe, carrying out the all-out struggle for revolution in this country and the development of the revolutionary struggle with a growing core committed to the cause of communism in other countries throughout the world. I think about an experience I had when I was forced into exile in France in the early 1980s. I met someone from Asia who was himself revolutionary-minded, and one of the first things they said to me was, "What's happening with black people in America? What's happening with their struggle? Have the imperialists been able to repress and contain them? It seems like they're not rising up the way they were before." And I said, "Well, maybe temporarily, but don't be too sure." This is the kind of impact that struggles in different countries can have, and let's face it, you want to talk about everybody knows? Here's an everybody knows it's true. Everybody knows that one of the hardest places in the entire world to make revolution is this country. And everybody knows that if there were a real revolution in this country, it would change the entire world and inspire people all over the world and change their way of looking at things in the world in a truly profound and radical way. I think about the common. You can learn from everybody, even from the people on the other side of the struggle. There was this British commentator talking about the Islamic fundamentalists in places like Britain and in the world in general, denouncing them as terrorists, which many of them actually do carry out terrorism, and what we are about has nothing to do with it, it's completely opposed to what they're about. But he made a very interesting comment, which he said a generation or two ago, these people would have been Maoists, communists. We should think deeply about that. You see, what he was saying is in a different world, when there was a socialist country in China, when there was a Cultural Revolution, when it stood for revolution and radiated revolution to the world and supported revolution around the world, that was a tremendous magnet of attraction for people. There's a lot of truth to that. Now, as I said, our objectives, our philosophy, our methods, our tactics, our goals, everything are completely and radically and fundamentally opposed, different from and opposed to Islamic fundamentalists, especially those who carry out terrorism, even targeting the people. But there's something important to learn here. It has something to say about what it will mean if a movement for revolution, even before we get to the point of all-out revolution, will have an influencing people all over the world. This is part of our internationalist responsibilities, but it's also something that we can play a big role in affecting. But as important as all that is, it is still not enough. We have to not only fight the power and transform the people, and yes, have a powerful impact on people and forces throughout the world while also learning from them, but we have to go on, and when the time is right, fight to actually win, to actually do what all this is for, making revolution and making even greater contributions to this revolution throughout the world.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian with Internationalism, The Whole World Comes First, and that's taken from his DVD, BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less. Let me tell you, sisters and brothers, you want to check more out on that, and we want to get more from Bob Avakian, go to revcom.us, okay? And you can get out what we need in the world today, okay? A cat who's actually not only developing the strategy and the science to make a revolution, but actually leading a revolution, okay? So check that out, because we cannot live under this hellhole much longer, okay? This is, nobody in the world can live under this. We're going to take a quick break and be back with my two guests, and we're going to be talking about their play. And the play is called Recorded in Hollywood, and it's going to blow your mind. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do. Whoa.
All right, I can see Teddy over there, and Teddy's just like swaying, and everybody in here is just swaying, and everybody wants to get up and start singing. And that was Sam Cooke with You Send Me, all right? And I'm playing that song because Sam Cooke was someone who was intimately involved, actually, and people will talk about, my guests will talk about this song in relation to the play and the main character of the play, the person that the play is actually, well, I'd say it's the person, it's about the person, but it's actually about what he brought into the world and what he was doing in the world. And the play is called Recorded in Hollywood. And it's a play about a record store and a record store owner who actually went out and shook the world up. Now, this is a play that I saw recently, but unfortunately, this was playing in Los Angeles, so you're not going to be able to go out and see it in other parts of the country. But I do think it's important for you to know about it, and I think it's important for people to hear about this story in particular, which is an interesting and important moment in history, with lots of lessons for today, including the importance of culture, the role of the police, and much, much more. And while you might not be able to see the play right now where you are in different parts of the country, you will be able to get the book that it's based on. And the book is by Jamel Dolphin, who is the grandson of John Dolphin, the guy that the story is about, that the play is about. And Jamel wrote a book called Recorded in Hollywood, and much of the play is based on that book. And you can find that book on Amazon, okay? So check that out. Now, we have sitting in studio with us author and producer Jamel Dolphin.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you got to speak up, brother.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's good. You are the grandson of John Dolphin, who
yes.
This play is about.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, yeah. All right, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And joining us as well is Lou Spisto, who's a producer of the play. Let me ask you, Jamel, first.
Sure.
Tell people what the play is about.
Well, the play, it is about my grandfather, John Dolphin, and it's about his shop that he opened in 1948 called Dolphins of Hollywood, which was named Dolphins of Hollywood after the fact. It was in South Central Los Angeles, but the fact that he couldn't actually have a business in Hollywood at the time because of the race issue, they wasn't allowing blacks to have businesses or be in Hollywood. So he decided to bring Hollywood to South Central, and he named his shop Dolphins of Hollywood. And that's what the story's about. It starts from 1948, pretty much, and it goes throughout the 50s. It's an incredible and detailed story that has been great. And also, just on another note, the city of Los Angeles just honored the shop. They renamed the Central and Vernon intersection Dolphins of Hollywood Square. And that happened yesterday, and we are very proud and very honored that he got this recognition.
Lou, what brought you to this play?
It's a great story, and when you know, I'm in the business of producing musicals and plays and other kinds of things, and I've done a lot of shows here in Southern California and on Broadway, and when I saw this material last year and I met Jamel, I was so touched by, first of all, here's a guy who deserves to be on stage. Not every character in life and not every story in life deserves to be on stage.
What are you saying?
Yes, exactly. Well, we might think we all are stage people. When you look at stories, you look at classic musicals like Gypsy or whatever the musical is, does this character need to sing? And the character of John Dolphin not only needs to sing, but his world is a world that sings. But add to that the fact that this is a story of civil rights, of taking a stand, a man who came to town to be a mogul. He wanted to be wealthy. He wanted to be powerful. He wanted to make his mark in the business, and he loved music. But he wound up realizing that the most powerful thing he could do would be take a stand for the community. So it was a great character. And the fact is, it's all true. In fact, in some ways, we didn't go as detailed as we could in the play because obviously for the economies of scale, when you're doing a 2.5-hour show, you can't have everything. But we have music and we have story and we have, unfortunately, situations with police that still exist today that are in our show. And we're really proud of what we were able to put on stage.
You know, as I said, I saw it when it was first produced, and I really liked it then. And actually, Jamel was up here talking with us back then, and it was interesting. But I also, when I saw it this time, you know, it seemed that it was like trimmed, but also sharpened. You know, and there was a lot in there that, you know, because it really struck me. It wasn't just that he couldn't rent a store in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, that was true. There was a lot of racist assaults on him that said, you know, he would show up to see as you portray in a play. He'd show up with his looking around and he talks to this white guy standing in the corner. And he's looking at the building that he wants to rent, and he tells the guy, and the guy says, I'm sorry, I'm waiting for somebody to get this. And he says, or the store's already being rented. Yeah. And he says, yeah, I'm the cat that's trying to rent it. And it's like, oh no, that's not going to work. But the fact, it's not just that he went down and said, I'm going to take this to South Central then, and I'll bring Hollywood to South Central. He actually there was a mission that was beyond, you know, you talked about he wanted to be a mogul, but he also had this thing of, there was something bigger going on. There was the love of the music, there was the impact of the music, which was really heavy. And as we go along, we'll talk about that more. But I was really moved by the fact that he was dedicated to bringing this music out, bringing it up for in its own right, but then also the impact that it had on people of all nationalities, all the white kids that were coming down there. You know, it was like really great.
Yeah. In 1953, he had reported that 40% of his business was white consumers. So, I mean, this is before Brown versus the Board of Education. So basically Jim Crow laws are still in effect. And this guy has a well-integrated store. I mean, this guy, but my grandfather, he has a well-integrated store, you know, in 1953 with 40% of his sales is by white consumers in all black area of town.
And he really did know music. I mean, we were talking last night with Jamel's uncles, who are the sons of John, and they were telling me stories about Charles Mingus and about the cats that kind of showed up at the shop, and he would sit with them and say, hey, you know, you need to just stop what you're doing a minute and take a listen to this, or why don't you think about this? So he was not just a businessman. He really did. I mean, he wasn't a singer. He wasn't an artist per se, but he was really a creative guy. And we say in the, you know, there's a little bit of a line in the play where he says at the very end, you know, I paved the way for guys like Berry Gordy. But in a way he did, and he did more than that, because he was selling and crossing boundaries 10 years earlier. So in the 50s, this was not, but he did love music. And when you think about all the people who came through that shop, from Billie Holiday to Ella Fitzgerald to Elvis Presley, if you wanted to sell on the West Coast, you had to stop at Dolphins. You know, so that's just one part of it. And then you have Huggy Boy and the DJs that he put on the air, which brought the white kids down to the shop. And that's another part of Dolphins. And then you have all the record labels, which alone would have been a big business and a great contribution. I mean, he was a triple threat, as we say.
Let's talk about the DJs, because that was really interesting too, because that was something I think, you know, I was talking to somebody this morning, and I was remembering Do the Right Thing, where Samuel Jackson was the DJ in the window, and I thought, damn, man, and because then I knew from seeing the play and reading your book, Jamel, and talking to people, that your grandfather was actually one of the first people to put a DJ in the window, and what that was meant to do, because it really did, it attracted people from all over. So let's talk about that a little.
Well, yeah, he started with the DJ idea. Simple fact, he knocked out the whole front wall of the store, and me put the glass window there specifically so people can see the DJ, you know, come into the shop or play or even dance outside of the shop. And you know, they had the speakers turned to the outside of the to the street so that he can talk to the people coming by and become more of a social kind of scene there. And then that's what happened. It became a really huge social scene where everyone would show up. They would have DJs. They would take requests from the DJ, and they would play the songs, and they would also go on live on the radio right there in that front window.
And it's interesting because you saw this thing about not just that it attracted, it brought in because they actually did broadcast it live over a radio station, but it reached a lot of the white kids in the city that might not have known about Dolphins. Sure. But it was also a time where actually the whole Central Avenue thing was going on, where you had a lot of white people coming down for the music, and it was and actually what was beautiful about it is you had people, you had Asians, you had Latinos, you had black people and you had white people mixing it up.
Yeah.
And what you guys presented on the stage there was all these people who, you know, it was, and you imagine this, it's like late 40s, 50s, in the 50s, and you're thinking, damn, man, here's all these white kids dancing with black kids, and then there's people just like, it meant nothing except that they were all there together for the music, and they were learning about each other, and they were learning about their places in the world and how to deal with this. It was a very, very moving story and a very, very powerfully portrayed in this, because you think about that and what it did. It was like that was not, you know, where the system wanted to take things at that moment.
Yeah, and it also from last night's show, we had a lady, very older lady, who was actually, you know, was part of that scene. She just spoke about her time. She's like, after hours, we all would go down to Dolphins. And she said, plenty of different races out there, and we all just got along. We all just wanted to dance and listen to the music.
And, you know, and it was open 24 hours a day. I mean, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
You know, the first store to be open 24/7. This guy was, he was amazing in the concepts. He came, you know, the buy one, get one free. Nobody had heard of that before. And he was promoting his own artists, you know, buy a Nat King Cole, I'll sell you one, I'll give you one of my people so my people become popular. And that's how he promoted careers.
Yeah, and people should know he actually these labels he had.
Yeah.
He did sign people, and he had people, what you portray in the play, where he had kids come in and other people come in and audition for this.
Yeah.
And then he would sign them and he would record them and he put a record out.
Now that same day.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite an amazing operation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, our show, you know, we really, you know, harken back to Jamel. I mean, Jamel had this idea of honoring his grandfather, and you know, it would have been a legacy that was lost, or just, you know, in the record books in L.A. And you know, started with the book a few years ago, and wrote a book, and then started thinking about ways to expose the book and, you know, put the story up on its feet. And they looked at doing a film, and then, you know, brought a couple of folks to the table and said, well, let's work on a film. But in the process, they said, well, maybe we should try the musical first. So this is an interesting thing that this story can be the musical. It can also be a film or television. But this is the first iteration of Jamel's dream. It's sort of like, take this, put it on the stage. And last year in the 99-seat run, which sold out 4 months and got great reviews, it was that first step. It was kind of seeing what the material could kind of be. But I think this year we were able to go further. We were able to go deeper. We wanted to show more of the community that he faced, the good and the bad. We had, by virtue of expanding the cast, we were able to put more diversity in the cast, because it was really important to show that the white kids were coming to the store, because that's what he was fighting against. He was fighting the cops, because they would stop the girls on the street and say, hey, you know, you're going to get raped if you go in there. You're going to get raped if you go to this neighborhood. I mean, we don't have even as strong a portrayal as we could, you know, if we were, you know, musical at a certain point, you have to say, okay, how can you put this on the stage? But it was pretty heavy. I mean, they were not happy that those kids were going down there.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jamel Dolphin and Lou Spisto. And they're the author of the book recorded in Hollywood. Did you also write the script for the play?
I co-wrote it with Matt Donnelly.
Okay.
Yes.
And Lou is a producer on the play, and it's really an important and really beautiful play. You're in there, and I'm teared up. Of course, I'm easy to tear up, but it was also I tear up, and you know, all these people are sitting around me, and there's scenes, there's high moments where everybody's on their feet and just cheering because you've been waiting. And one of the things you've been waiting about is just what you've just been talking about, Lou, is the relationship with the police. Because it wasn't just that they wanted to go after him, as you're saying. It wasn't just that they wanted to go after him for just making too much noise or not, you know, not paying him off or doing this or doing that. But it really struck to the core, to the heart of a lot of what they were afraid of in the society, what they remain afraid of today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The idea of black people are something, they're a group of people that should not be allowed to thrive.
Yeah.
And what happens then, it's also they're bringing all these white people in. Young white guys, young white women, people who are digging the music. They're out there at 3 o'clock in the morning partying all night because of the music. Their ears are glued to the radio. You know, I read something recently where a cat was saying he got up at like 3 o'clock in the morning to see. I think it was in your book where he said he got up to think about he would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning out in the valley and turn the radio on outside and try and just listen to
so he
could hear Huggy Boy.
Yeah.
You know, you think about this, it's very heavy because that brought a hell of a response from the police. Let's talk about that a little.
Sure. Well, the thing was, Huggy Boy was so, you know, influential and so powerful as a DJ there that any song that he would play, if he played it enough, it would become a hit. So Huggy Boy was huge at that aspect. And then Huggy Boy was also the main reason why, the main attraction that was bringing the white kids down. And then the white kids would come there to see Huggy Boy. They would just get involved with the community and the shop. And what that portrayed to the police is that the race mixing wasn't something they was really ready for at that time. And especially with the chief of police, William Parker at the time, who was definitely, had his hate for, I would say, Central Avenue and the race mixing that was going on at that time.
Well, and we talked yesterday with this woman who was living at that time, and she said the Central and Vernon, which was still, obviously, we were there yesterday, Central and Vernon, which is a large square, the entire square block was filled, the street was filled with kids all night long, hanging out, having a good time, everybody was peaceful, just dancing, loving the music. It's sort of like this fantasy world that you can imagine, like, what a great thing. And we try to capture some of that spirit in our show where we've got these kids coming in and they're breaking out into dance. And the thing is, in a musical, it's very hard. We call it the suspension of disbelief, where you have to take a character and he or she's got to be telling you something and speaking something. And all of a sudden they start singing and dancing. And a lot of times it doesn't really work because why is that happening? But in this story, it really happened. People actually sang in the shop. People actually danced in the shop. People actually broke out into song, whether it was songs from the radio or songs that they were trying to pitch. All of this is why I think this is such a special musical.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think back on this question of the police and the relationship with this, because this was actually, again, much more than the first version of this. It was actually a central point of this play, and it was very heavy because exactly this thing of, I mean, look, you know, the police department there is the Newton Division, which is notorious.
Yeah.
It's notorious for murdering people to this day. There were times when I knew people that were living in Watts that would talk about they got taken to the Newton Division and the walls were crusted with dried blood of the holding cells, you know? And this was just 5-10 years ago.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that you see, that this fascistic assault on people. And again,
how many times did they throw your grandfather in jail? I mean, they were always thrown in jail for something.
Yeah, always.
Every time they could, you know, he'd walk down the street crooked and he'd be thrown in jail.
Yeah, I've read articles in the old Sentinel and also the California Eagle at that time, which were more black publications. But they had an article in there that when I was doing my book, that stated how the police would follow John home, go to his house, knock on his door, ask him to come outside, and then they'll arrest him.
Yeah.
As soon as he stepped outside. I mean, this is crazy. This is all documented.
They were not happy. He was doing well. The kids were coming down. He was making a buck and thriving, and it was not sitting well.
And this is a time, this went right up in the face of the things that Parker was about, that the whole way of, you know, penning black people into a certain area and just like, this is it. We run you. You live at our leisure, then this is not going to be broken.
Yeah.
And the danger that posed of white people coming in and genuinely having friendly, fun times with each other. You know, it was very cool. I want to ask you one more question here. I think we have time for maybe one more. One thing is I want to talk a little bit about some of the artists that you wouldn't expect to have come into Dolphins and actually done this stuff. And there's two of them in particular. One is Charles Mingus.
Yeah.
You know, because you would not put Charles, even though, you know, and it's sort of like a trope, and it's sort of like this thing where there's a point here where everybody says, okay, yeah, well, jazz was big in South Central, which it was, and it was big, sure. It was big around Central and Vernon as well. But there was Charles Mingus coming into a store that was actually more centered around sort of rock music, you know, which was kind of very heavy to me.
Yeah, rock and pop.
Yeah, well, the thing was, this was late 49, 50 was when Charles Mingus was first recording with my grandfather. So the doo-wop and the early R&B wasn't so set in just yet. It was still coming. And jazz was probably on his way towards bebop, more bebop of a sound. And that's what my grandfather was basically stating to Charles Mingus and Buddy Collette. They was there at the same time. And he would tell them, like, you know, what you're doing is great, it's jazz, but jazz is moving more towards bebops, more of that Miles Davis type of sound. And that was, that was his way of telling them what he was looking for out of them. And, you know, they took that, and they all became, like, great jazz musicians. I mean, some of the best of all time.
Yeah, and a lot of people, and again, if we had more time, we could talk about the connection with Sam Brown and Jefferson High School all the jazz musicians that came up out of there. Horace Tapp's got all these people, and all the rock musicians, including the people, you know. I mean, it's just an endless roster of people that came up out of that school and that were tied in with your grandfather, too. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I'm not going to ask you about the second. I realized, as I said, I was going to talk about the second group of unexpected musicians that came in, but folks, you got to see it because it'll knock your socks off when you find out at the end who those second group of musicians were, all right? It'll really blow your mind. All right, Jamel, Lou, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Sure.
All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with the author and producers of the play recorded in Hollywood. And I want to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix and these folks. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my board offer today, and always, Teddy Robinson. And again, you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And once again, do not forget to go to revcom.us and check all the stuff that's going on in the world today, all right? Talk to you again next week.